Good afternoon, and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast, A Look at the Future of Patient Monitoring. My name is Rich Nass, and I am the Executive Vice President of Open Systems Media. I lead the Embedded Computing Design team, where we talk about embedded and IoT and industrial and medical, which is what we're talking about today. But more importantly, I will be your moderator for this webcast. On this webcast, you'll be hearing from two stars of our industry, one who's a frequent guest on this channel. That would be Stan Schneider, who is the CEO of Real-Time Innovations, also known as RTI. He is on the IIC Steering Committee and is its testbed chair. He was recently named as one of Embedded Computing Design's top embedded innovators of the year and IoT1's top 10 most influential people in the industrial IoT. He holds a PhD in electrical engineering and computer science from Stanford University. You'll also be hearing from Oliver Astley, the CTO for Mobile Digital Health at GE Healthcare. Oliver completed his PhD in electrical engineering at McGill University in Montreal. After that, he joined GE Global Research, working primarily on R&D for healthcare. About 4 years ago, Oliver took on his current role, which includes developing a true healthcare IoT that provides data-driven insights to help caregivers make decisions that in turn improve patient outcomes. Okay, let me talk about what we'll be talking about today and what you can expect to learn from today's webcast. I don't think anybody would argue that hospitals of the future will be maximizing their connectivity, everything from patient monitoring to medical devices and everything in between. And they might also add in some levels of AI for decision making. Some of this is already taking place, and if you need evidence of that, just ask the folks at GE Healthcare and RTI, and they will tell you. In this webinar, you'll learn how the healthcare industry can tap into the power of the IoT and how hospitals with smart devices and algorithms will be connected through easy, reliable, and secure data sharing. That just sounds so interesting on so many levels. I'm very excited about this. But before we do that, I have to go over some of the housekeeping stuff. The whole presentation will take about 45 minutes or so, and that'll leave us some time to answer your questions, and we will get to as many as time permits. You'll find on your console window an area where you can enter your questions in real time. And as I said, we'll address as many as we can when the speakers are done with their presentations. If we don't get a chance to answer your question, somebody will get back to you after the webcast is over with an answer. So all questions will be answered. If you have a question that pertains to the operation of the webcast itself, like the slides aren't working or there's a problem with the audio, put that question into the box and one of our technicians will get back to you. On the console, there's a maximize button that allows you to see the slides in a larger window. And this webcast will be available in an archived version about 48 hours after we sign off today. So if you miss something or if you want to go back and review or if you want to send it to a friend, it'll be there for you. Okay, enough for me. Let's hand it off to Stan, who will take it away. Stan?
Hi. So I'd like to start with this slide that the smart machine era is going to be most disruptive in history. One of Gartner's claims, I suppose, is about 3 or 4 years old now. I think it's completely true. If you actually look at the history of computing, processor and networking are about 10,000 times better, faster, denser, whatever you want to say, than they were 20 years ago. And in another 20 years, there will be something like another 10,000 times better. And that fact is changing all industries, but the question we have today is, what does that really mean for healthcare? If you look at today's hospitals, you walk around, virtually everything you see there is smart. They all have processors and computers in it, but they really aren't very connected to anything, to each other. They can't work together. In the future, they'll have a lot more opportunity to work together and especially work with algorithms and AI and clinical decision support systems to make things safer, better, smarter for patients. And if you walk around a hospital, also it seems like everything's reasonably organized and running smoothly, and it is, but it's actually a very complex environment, especially complex IT environment, to really deliver the critical care on time that you need. It's just not simple, and it is a great opportunity that we have in this age to have technology join the care team. I like to say that historians look back on our time and wonder how we got by without smart things, just like we wonder how people got by without electricity or cars and things like that. It really is an amazing time to be making this contribution. I think there's a great future for healthcare in lots of areas, and in this webinar with Oliver, who's the CTO of Mobile Digital Health at GE Healthcare, we're going to try and show you a glimpse of that future and why it's important and how we think it's going to happen and what the technology potential really is out there. I'll start with Oliver giving you a little bit of overview. So why is the patient monitoring challenge relevant to the Internet of Medical Things, the Internet of Things for Medicine? Maybe you could give us a quick overview.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. So maybe before we go anywhere, let's make sure we understand what the problem we're trying to solve is. And so, you know, I've been working in this industry for several years now, and it's just incredible how complex it is. It starts off looking relatively simple, but once you start understanding workflows, you see just what the data jungle that we have in front of us. So you see in the picture, this is an OR. Operating room, and patient monitoring is happening in this case. We have an anesthesiology unit, which is dispensing anesthesia to the patient, and we have several monitors monitoring the vital signs of the patient. Now, you can see that there is a range of those sensing, we call them parameters, which could be on the patient at any given time, each one of them producing data. So it could be the oxygenation level, for example, your blood pressure, your breathing rate, your ECG or your cardiac electrical signals. We call those parameters, and there's a diverse set that are available to customers today. But the devices themselves are also wide ranging. Like in the ones in the picture, you can see they are standing on machines, but we have devices that are wireless, that run on batteries. The compute in them are embedded. So we have to be able to deal with a wide range of devices with a wide range of parameters, all of them producing data. Now, in this particular picture, you've got one patient, but as you go in, you know, the hospital, obviously, there are many patients. So I scale that system to tens of patients, hundreds of patients, and some of the hospitals, especially in the U.S., are talking thousands of patients that are being monitored at any given time. Now, those are networked as well. So we've been networking in this business for about 30 years in GE Healthcare. But that was before the days of, we talked about things like analytics, for example. So we're having to think about how we manage data and how we manage patient outcomes in a wholly different way because of the new technology, the opportunities new technology gives for us. But at the end of the day, when you think about what we're trying to do in patient monitoring, it's actually pretty simple, right? We are using sensors, using devices, potentially and algorithms to monitor the health of the patient, and in particular, raise an alarm if we start seeing some kind of degradation, that is, we see the patient start going downhill. At the end of the day, your mother can be at the end of, you know, your mother, your father, your loved one, and yourself can be at the end of that machine. And so we feel a big responsibility to make sure that we have them, which is incredibly reliable, working 24/7. So that's kind of the big picture view of what we try to do in patient monitoring stand.
Okay, before we get off the slide, and why is that hard? What do you have to overcome to do that? What are you really trying to do to deliver to the care team?
So maybe the first thing I'll say, I just kind of mentioned it, it's the 24/7, right? So when we talk about reliability, we need to make sure, you know, these devices could be connected to you for 24 hours a day, for 2 or 3 days while you're in the hospital. And they're used to allow 2 or 3 nurses to monitor, you know, 24, 30 beds of patients. So we need to have the reliability because if the system starts going down every 10 minutes, you don't get the nurses can't keep track of what's happening with each patient, and obviously bad things can happen. So the first of all, I would say is reliability. The second is scalability. So we'll probably talk about a lot of abilities, Dan. Yeah, but There are hospitals which will run 10 beds or a ward which may be 24, 40 beds. But then that starts scaling. So the same technology that works for 10 beds needs to be able to work for 1,000 beds or 1,000 patients and be doing that all reliably and be connected at all times. And that connection can happen across non-co-located areas. So what I mean by that, and you think you walk in this hospital and you go and you try to figure out where you have to go, right? They could be non-co-located because they're on different floors of a hospital. But increasingly, you see hospital campuses, so they could be in different buildings. And believe it or not, they can even be in different parts of the world. There are some hospitals which are monitoring their patients at night in actual different countries in different time zones as shifts change and things like this. So it's highly reliable, has to be very scalable, connected across non-co-located areas, and the data has to be accessible, right? So we're increasingly used to being able to see, be it our bank account, for example, a movie on Netflix on any device at any given time. And we start to expect that. And we need to do a better job, I think, of that in the healthcare industry. So that data has to be accessible, which means we can't have data belonging to the patient monitor or a box anymore. So we have to kind of think of differently that way. And we have to be device agnostic now. I mean, we only work for these on one or two devices. We need to be able to do the entire range. And last but not least, it has to be secure. Security in the same way you need to worry about security in your house, or the banks need to manage security, we have to do the same thing in the hospital industry as well. So I would say that those are the key reasons why it's hard, because all those problems need to be solved simultaneously over a wide range of operating space. And a wide range of customers too. I mean, unlike, say, a data center, which is a nicely controlled environment, every hospital installation is a little different for us. So you can't have something which is so form fit that it only works in a very narrow band of hospitals. The kind of equipment we make has to be able to work in a large hospital institution like Cleveland Clinic, for example, in the United States, and it has to be able to work across any country in the globe. So you see a lot of different environments. So, in this picture, just to kind of reiterate a little bit, you saw the operating room. Here's an example, we call it a nurse's station. And essentially, this is a situation where you can see that the patient in the background, and that's just one patient of many, and you see the nurse or doctor is there at the desk, and they are looking across the patient. If they get an alarm or they see something interesting, or see something that piques their interest, they can then go deeper and understand what is going on with that patient. Actually, I think in this particular picture, they're looking at the ECG signals. And so that's an example of that connectivity. Here, you've got, for the purpose of the photograph, it's all in one shot, but that could be completely non-co-located in some cases. So there's an example where you've got remote monitoring, reliability, it's in intensive care. I always remember, my mother could be at the end of it, and then data availability. We need to have that data available. And as you can see, the doctors in the corner, they could be looking at that same data on a completely different we call it pane of glass, but being like an iPad situation, for example. So that's kind of the big picture view of the problem what we're trying to solve and why it's hard then. So I think, Stan, we've been working together, our company's been working together, and I think one of the things which is interesting to us in the healthcare industry is, have you seen those challenges and those analogs in other industries? So how is IoT changing industry, and how can we move that over into that healthcare space, do you think?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I get that all the time. I live in the IoT industry these days and have a lot of interaction. And I'll go through my quick view of what the IoT is really all about. It's really all about taking all these different industries that all have some special capabilities, things they've developed over the years, and taking the technologies, the best from each of them, and merging them all together, really, to make all industries better. It's an amazing opportunity, but that's really what's going on. and it's exciting. And if you actually look at, you know, this is just sort of RTI's view of what's going on. These are all some of our customers' applications we've been working with for many years. And they're all distributed, intelligent machines. You know, we're deeply involved in transportation. We're over 200 autonomous vehicles and smart trains and air traffic control in Canada. We're running 30 airports in China, Hyperloop, flying cars, power, wind turbines, Navy ships, all of these things, and medical outside of monitoring, like imaging and treatment systems and robotics. And in all of these things, they're really facing the same kinds of challenges that are really not easy to take on without some technology that might not have been developed in that industry. So all of them, from our point of view, really have two things in common. They have what I have called functional artificial intelligence, which isn't necessarily, you know, deep learning and back propagation, although a lot of times it is, and pervasive networking. Both of these, I consider them the largest thoroughfares in technology today. They're really changing everything, and, you know, it really is an exciting time and place to be able to put those together. But we're finding out that, you know, it's not that easy to do these kinds of things all the time. Just having intelligence and having the network isn't enough. You need to really be able to handle reliability, millisecond timing, software coordination, many, many devices, scalability. All those things are huge challenges in the world.
So Stan, I mean, let's go a level deeper. So the good news is that we've got a lot of analogs in industry outside of the healthcare industry, which is a conservative industry, to be frank. I mean, you have to be conservative when people's lives are on the line, and I've always respected that. And so it's good having some of those analogs so that we can see how that will translate into the medical space. But there's also a lot of different technologies that we could choose in monitoring, yet we go with DDS. Can you just talk a little bit in more detail about why you think DDS differentiates itself with some of the challenges that I talked about earlier with respect to scalability and different devices and data accessibility?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, first of all, the confusion is warranted. There's at least, at least five or six standards and dozens of other technologies that call themselves real-time published subscribe middleware, to the point where those words don't really mean anything, because real-time means something different. Everybody can publish subscribe. We publish subscribe to very different things, and middleware is famously hard to define. And, you know, really, we look at it as there's a lot of different technologies out there. It's truly amazing how similar they sound and how different they are. So, you know, DDS is one of the connectivity frameworks. The IIC, I'm the vice chair of the IIC now, put together a deep analysis of these things called the IICF, the Industrial Internet Connectivity Framework, very much worth going and looking at. But the acronyms and the technologies, though, they're very confusing. You know, IIC actually analyzed all of these on here except Kafka. I threw Kafka in here because we get questions about that sometimes. But, you know, DDS isn't really very much like Kafka at all. It doesn't have servers the way people think of servers. I'll talk about that in a little bit, but, it's faster, it's peer-to-peer, it's designed to run not in the edge, and the cloud servers are easy, on the edge servers are pain points, it supports multicast and runs on 100 different platforms, and they're just really different. So it's the confusion is pretty easy to understand. They're superficially quite similar, but in reality, they're vastly different technologies. And I can't go through all of them here. Actually, I had a whole webinar series on going over most of these. You're welcome to go back and look at that, or the ebook. But I will definitely give you an idea why this makes sense for the monitoring case in particular here. But the fundamental thing that DDS does that's different, you need to understand this, and I'll apologize for the background here a little bit. is something called data centricity, which is literally putting data in the center. Systems are about data. Data-centric systems connect everything through the data instead of to each other. It's a very simple concept. It's actually very well known in other areas, especially in storage. Everybody knows a data-centric technology called database. When you work with a database, you as a person, as an application, whatever, talk to the database. You don't talk to the 5,000 other applications and things in the database that are also talking to the database. And so in that case, the database owns the data, and it can now manage truth. And that's really the fundamental thing that data centricity means, is the infrastructure understands the data and manages truth. It owns the data. In DDS, we're going to see the network sort of owns the data. And that orange box there that says data, don't underestimate that. That, in DDS speak, is the entirety of all data in the hospital or beyond the hospital, all the patients, all the algorithms, everything there sort of lives in this little orange thing that we just call data on the box. We call it a virtual global address space. But it really creates this illusion that everybody has all the data right there in its system. And that is a really hard concept for people to grasp.
Yeah. Stan, I'll just interrupt you for a second. It's interesting because you use the term data centricity, and in our field, we call it patient centricity. And data is data centricity is the means to do that. So it becomes that is important for us because we don't want a device owning the data, so to speak. We want that accessibility. And so we've had to changing the way we think about data such that at any given time we have that connection between the patient's history, what's happening today, what devices they've been on, been on the past, what they're on the present. And that's data centricity, or in our language, patient centricity. So it's interesting, we came into similar but slightly different terms.
Yeah, and it's actually not, that's not an accident. It's exactly correct, because with data centricity, you can have data about the patient, Oliver, and that is a meaningful thing with DDS. It really means that's Oliver's data, and I'm going to track that around, or whatever I'm going to do with that data. It really does let you have a patient-centric thing instead of a device-centric or a network-centric or an IP address or all these other ways to access information. I can access Oliver. It's a very different kind of concept. Just to finish my little background here, maybe we should talk a little bit about what you really need, where we see DDS fitting in, and especially why it works for monitoring, I suppose. So the fundamental key things, these are my famous five questions, I suppose. If you answer all of these questions, yes, you definitely need DDS. If you actually go back and look at my list of applications before, all of them have at least three, and most of them have four or five of these. Really, it can't stop even for 1 minute. It can't, you often say the word milliseconds, that counts. Most all of our applications are building large software systems, so it's really an example of software eating the world. And you're sending information more than just trying to collect it in the cloud. You need to use it right then and there. You need to set off an alarm that's meaningful there in the OR or the ICU without having to depend on some remote connectivity or timing or something like that. So it really is a new generation of intelligent distributed systems, and we're excited about GE Healthcare taking advantage of that.
Well, I can tell you, Stan, that I was in a design review just recently. We were talking about 25 milliseconds at length and at nauseam. So we have more than 10 software engineers. We clearly have severe consequences if things don't work out. And this is really the next generation that we're building. So we're actually checking 5-year boxes.
Okay, so anyhow, I thought maybe we could go through some examples of what the challenges are in hospitals. And by the way, I'm getting a question here that what does DDS stand for? It stands for Data Delivery Service. It's a standard by the organization called the OMG Object Management Group. It's a network connectivity standard. So, anyhow, Oliver, maybe we could talk about some of the, places in the hospital that are challenges and why the data network has to be robust to that kind of environment, that would be great.
Yeah, I think maybe the first thing I would say, so this is a picture actually of a patient being moved from one location to the other. We call that transport. And so one of the things about the hospital environment for us is that, as I mentioned earlier, everyone is different. There's not one cookie cutter hospital. That doesn't exist. Okay, so for us, I always tell the team here, the real world is noisy and it's unpredictable. And there's most of the time things are looking really good, but we have to be able to handle those edge cases or the tightening. There are situations which happen once in a while, and that's when things start going wrong. And that's what's important in the design of our networks, systems. So because the real world is noisy and unpredictable, we have to assume that networks and parts of networks will go down. Now, we design our patient monitors to be robust to that. But our data network as well needs to be able to gracefully recover. So let's imagine that the network goes down in a section of the hospital, or well, there's an interruption. You know, someone's doing some repair somewhere. I mean, it happens all the time. What happens to that data? We want to make sure that the data, for some reason, can't go from A to B at that point, that system can recover. It knows that the data did not get there, and we'll try again, and then try again. And then as soon as everything gets put kind of back together and you're back into that normal steady state, everything kind of self-heals, so to speak. And we need to be able to do that design with that in mind, because hospitals are noisy and unpredictable. Another way to think about it is, in this case, for example, the patient is being moved. And while that patient is moved, they could be put into an elevator. It happens all the time. And then you hit a dead zone in network connectivity. So that's the case where the network is actually fine. You're just in the wrong place. But we don't want to be at wrong place at the wrong time, right? So there's an example where you say, look, but then you're going to connect into another network. So now we have to go through those non-co-located sites. We need to make sure that the data that wasn't getting put through while the patient was in the elevator is actually getting to its destination. So you kind of have to have a seamless transfer. And from a design perspective, we don't want to be having to have our monitors worry about, do I talk to this device, that device, this device. We want it to be as transparent as possible. To our device, to the software running in those devices, which is one of the things that the state of centricity gives with us, in DDS. So in that scenario, and when we get to that data centricity and that patient centricity, we can't have that box on the data. The network does, and that's to what Stan was talking about earlier, about his orange data block. And so, I mean, those are a couple of examples of those use cases where data centricity starts the matter. And then at the same time, while all that is happening, we may have algorithms and stuff running in the background, and we want them to be accessible to the nurses and the doctors. So if you have everything trapped, so to speak, on that box that you see there, you can't necessarily do that in a very efficient manner. You want to be able to do it where compute resources are more ubiquitous or more available and sometimes cheaper, for example, not necessarily in the patient monitor. But the patient monitor, maybe you want to get results. So you've got this whole challenge of patient movement, networks going up and down, sometimes being able to deal with that noisy environment. And then also you have these devices, which, we don't want to make them do everything for every little task necessary. We want to offload that to the places where it's best done. And then being able to bring the results in, for example, on that. So that's a very typical, I would call it not even a corner case, but just one of those trickier cases, Stan, that we have to be able to deal with. It's not just the patient sitting in the hospital, in their bed, waiting to be discharged. There's a lot of the dynamic environment. So DDS, it helps in this manner? Stan?
Yeah, so Yeah, this is sort of the crux of data centricity, and we'll get into a little bit more detail with mobility later. But just, you know, think about you had an algorithm somewhere, running somewhere, you know, maybe somewhere in the hospital, maybe in a device that is monitoring the patient. The patient's moving, and the algorithm needs to work no matter where the patient is or what the patient does. So I love the whole patient centricity. It's about the patient. In a data-centric world, the patient devices are producing data, but to everything else, including the algorithm, the data isn't about the device, it's about the patient. So it doesn't really care what device produced the data, as long as it's the right data, as long as it got there at the right time, as long as it's reliable. It doesn't matter what processor generated it or how it was transmitted over the network, and there's lots of different kinds of networks in hospitals. As long as it's there, the right data is there at the right time with the right quality, everything's there. And it's sort of what the whole concept of data centricity and DDS is all about. DDS actually knows the data, so it's not sending opaque pipes around. Most other things send opaque data, which means you don't know what's in it. You're just sending a message. It's not about messages. It's about the patient. So it knows things like the patient's name or the patient's ID or whatever else that has that data. And it's just, you know, the device is just writing the patient Oliver. It actually looked like in local memory. And to the algorithm, it's just reading patient Oliver. And it, all the details of how the data got there is sort of hidden. You have to go through a little bit more detail how that actually works to explain that. But, you know, just there's no dependence on the network or IP address or processor architecture or the device. If you need 12 lead ECG at 50 hertz within a tenth of a second, you can ask for that directly, and the middleware will go and get it if it can. If it can, it'll tell you it can't. If it can, it will do there. And everything else is really just the detail. So, you know, that's sort of what I meant by being a source of truth in the system. It provides the information you need to create a good thing. But, you know, it brings up the question, well, where does the data live? Which, in a large distributed system, especially with real-time data, isn't an easy question to sort of understand. And I'll very quickly go through sort of the whole concept of how this works. And it doesn't have servers. It doesn't have services, and we'll talk about the difference in a second. But a server to me is something that is absolutely required to even get up and running that connects things together and stuff like that. So there's this concept of global data space, and all the data lives in that space. It's a virtual concept. Doesn't really exist. It's simulated to exist, or seems like it exists, just like a virtual machine. Discovery's automatics. Everybody, all the algorithms, all the devices, all the whatever is there can find out about each other. I'm not going to go through how that works because you sort of have to understand DDS first. It is a special topic. And then you just read and write in your own language and operating system and things like that. And, you know, the way it works is you've got some device here that is going to write ECG data for Oliver. And actually knows, I'm going to use your name. I'm sorry, Oliver. I know you're not probably sick. I'll use my name later too, just so we can be fair. But, you know, it just says, okay, I'm going to write this data 50 times a second. I've got, 500 buffers, so I can keep it reliable for 10 seconds. I can retry if you lose it. It's ECG data for Oliver. And it, the topic might be Oliver, but it definitely knows it's there, and it, the type, whatever, it understands all of that. And the fact that I said I can produce it causes it to exist in this space. There's nothing else that has to happen. There's no server that has to be notified or anything like that. Discovery just happened. And then, you know, someone else requests it, some algorithm or something like that. Maybe it doesn't want it as fast. I don't think it was really a good ECG example, but, you know, and I only want Oliver. You know, maybe this thing is producing it for a lot of different patients. And you notice its type here is a little bit different, type prime here, and now that type is also in the space. It knows both of those types exist. And the original producer just now knows it has a contract. They're called a contract with the data bus, with the data space. And it says, okay, well, if I'll send 10 a second if it's Oliver. It's really that simple. Where does the data live? Well, it's living in the device here. It's living over there. Often you need it persisted on the network. There are persistent servers. The difference between a server and a services, there's persistent services, is that you can have many of them that are just sort of causing backup or even doing repairs. If you lose data, doing retries and things like that, if the device itself isn't capable or is busy with something else or is a small device or something like that. So the system can be made robust. But the whole concept is all about this finding things, sending it the right data, and there's something called quality of service control that has, you know, a couple of examples here. 10 times a second, that's a quality of service. Reliability, well, we didn't need it here, but it's possible to have reliability for 10 seconds. Liveliness is, do I actually have data? So that's an alarm condition that there is no data, potentially, right? No data and not getting the data are two very different things. We can tell the difference between that. And then security and all that is also rolled into it. So it's an interesting, different way of thinking about the world. And, you know, it has a some pretty interesting implications. And I love this slide that you guys do that you call the grand challenge. I just love to understand a little more about the grand challenge of scalability in a real-world environment. Easy, a little picture like that. But
I'll walk you through. Actually, if you just go back to the previous page, I'll also give you another example, which I think is relative, kind of shows some of the stuff that we're trying to do that, put that in action. So some of our devices, you know, our devices all have compute, for example, but we're trying to actually minimize what happens on the device. We want that to be a software service. And so in the same way we've got reducers of data, we can have algorithms that are consuming data, and they can consume it. So I'll give you an example. We do something called trends. So trends is a way to give a physician or a nurse a view of what's the overall direction of a patient vital sign over a period of several hours or even, you know, 12 hours, even a day, right? And it gives you more of a macro view. Rather than put that into all our devices, the direction that we want to go is we'll have that as a service, and we'll put that where compute is cheapest, maybe on a larger computer in a data center somewhere, for example, and that becomes a consumer of that data, but then it also starts producing data as well, right? And so our devices can then, which traditionally would have done all that calculation themselves, now can look out to the network and say, please give me the trend data. And they start getting that, the trend data. So you can have an interesting network of producers and consumers all interacting with each other. And what we're trying to do is put the right compute resources in the right places with a good level of redundancy to ensure that robustness as well. So there's kind of an example of that one in motion, Stan.
That's a great example, and it's also a good example of the whole concept that it's about the data. With lots of other kinds of things, if you're sending messages, for instance, if you have a messaging system in general, you're sending messages from something to something, and those kinds of concepts you just talked about with, I want the data to sort of be, live with the patient and be the first class citizen, just isn't easy, if you have to have this sort of, abstraction of messages and things being sent somewhere instead of an abstraction of it's about the data or about the patient. So it's a great great example.
So let's go to the grand challenge.
Okay, the grand challenge. Love this slide. Terrifying slide.
You know, I will credit this page to the chief engineer in our organization, Matt Grubis, who outlined this. And you know, the patient monitoring business is very interesting. I call it, you know, you peel the onion. It looks very simple from the outside. Oh, it's a bunch of waveforms on a screen. As you peel the onion, you see it gets more and more complex. It gets more and more complicated and deeper. So what we're showing here is kind of a view of a hospital, right? And so there's, within the hospital, you've got a whole set of different, care levels, right? So the ICU, the intensive care unit, you've got the surgery, the post-anesthesia care unit, or PACU. And they could be on different floors, different parts of the hospital. But they're all interconnected, and you want them interconnected as you go. And then, as I mentioned earlier, hospitals now are becoming distributed, non-collocated on campuses and things like this, especially in the United States. And so you have this interconnection of all these devices.
So one of the things we talk about robustness, but the grand challenge for us is this. So if you look on the top left, we could, actually, if you hit the animation a couple of times down for me. Yeah. So we kind of, like, this is the thought experiment. You can see we've got the little no entry sign. That for us is to just simulate, at least conceptually, what happens if the network connection, in this case, between a cardiac care unit and some edge compute, breaks or gets interrupted for whatever reason. We can't have the situation that those people in the bottom left who are monitoring those people in the cardiac care unit, right? So cardiac care, they're monitoring the, you know, these are people with weak hearts, problematic hearts. We have to monitor, they are high-risk patients. We can't have the whole system go down. If you have 40 or 50 patients, and then you may have 3 or 4 nurses looking over them, they can't be at all places at the same time. Generally, what will happen is that you may lose that, you have that interruption between, you know, that floor and the rest of the world, that subnet and the rest of the world. So, you know, it could be happening for 5, 10 minutes or whatever the situation. We need to still make sure that that data is getting to the people who are kind of locally on that floor. So remember the nurses station I showed you earlier? That still has to get there. So when we look at the problem of the grand challenge, we don't really want all the data going up to some kind of central server and always kind of coming back, because it's pretty dangerous for us, for the patient. And so you can imagine different types of outages. And so in the design of the system, we go through these failure modes analysis to say, how would we recover? How would we recover? So that's where also where quality of service comes in as well, because there are some functions which are very useful, but not necessarily always life critical. So that allows us to do things like we need to prioritize what data goes from A to B, what needs to be, if when we switch it back on, when the network reconnects, what needs to get there first. And so that's how we start building out the problem. So this is the grand challenge, the grand thought experiment for us from an engineering perspective, how we want to design a system that is robust. And maybe one of the big, you know, takeaways is that, for me, is always that we have to give some level of operation. We just have to assume that bad things will happen. And so locally, what can we keep going, even though maybe on a macro scale in the hospital, something bad is happening. And so that's the grand challenge. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, it makes sense. But, you know, as a networking specialist here, if there's people out there, I suppose I should finish the animations here. You know, how can this possibly work? It should strike. It strikes terror to any network design. You know, you lose a device. Well, okay, that's something you can handle. You lose the whole ward. That's a different issue. You lose the central server. Most designs are not robust to that kind of thing. You lose connectivity off-site. I mean, all these things happen in the real world, but if you really need to be super reliable, if lives are on the line here, you just can't do that. And it's really hard to do this if you think about all the data connection has to flow through pipes, which this diagram sort of looks like pipes. You can't lay enough pipes. You can't move data between pipes. You can't fail over and back up to different pipes and throw valves, and the whole idea of data and pipes doesn't work. But you know, DDS doesn't, data centricity doesn't look like pipes. If you have to use the water thing, it looks like little puddles in every single device, and that puddle is filled with whatever that device needs, and the route doesn't matter. If there's any way to get the data there, there's no backup or things like that. In fact, our default behavior, if we have multiple networks, like there's a wired and a wireless network or something, to send the data over all the networks you have available, it might not be efficient, but it's the default behavior, because the reliability of getting the data there should take advantage of whatever there. So there's no physical routers and no path routes. There's, no sort of, dependence on the physical layout, as long as the data can get there somehow. And most systems have more redundancy, you might think, in the way the network's put together. That's an easier to solve problem. The hard part is getting the data flow to use the redundancy that you can put into the network. So that's sort of what we do.
Thing,
we actually call it.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Stan, just sorry to interrupt. So the other thing which is you're talking about the pipes, and you know, when you do the plumbing, you know, you don't want to, you can't lay down all the pipes. It's not at the beginning thinking about what you'll have at the end. That's, I remember we talked earlier about scalability. The reality will be that a lot of hospitals don't start with this big picture. They start as a microcosm of this. And then they call us and say, hey, we want to go into this, and we want to grow into that, and we want to go into this direction. And it, you know, we can't. It's malpractice for us as engineers that we go back to the hospital and say, oh, you have to rip everything out and put it back together again, right? So that's what the scalability means. The reality will be that a lot of hospitals start with, you know, maybe the top right-hand corner, and then they start to grow out. And then they say, okay, so we need to be able to do that scalability. And then the second question they come is, oh, I want to make sure that the devices, what they really mean is the data can go between each of those subunits as well.
Yeah, that's an absolutely classic problem is, you know, the networks evolve, things evolve. Often the vendor, like, you know, GE Healthcare in this case, doesn't have control over the hospital's IT networks. I mean, you can install some special purpose things, but if you have to do everything special purpose and every single application needs special purpose networking, it gets crazy very fast. So it's better to be able to handle be able to use whatever network capability there and have the design itself understand and know if it's sufficiently capable to do what the algorithms need, because that's what you need. You don't need to think of it all ahead of time. You need to make sure it's going to work. And I know that's hard, but that's sort of where we are.
It's a good example. I think one of the things is worth talking about is the data router in DDS, because I think that was when I started to learn about DDS and thinking about it for the grand challenge. I think that was a critical concept, which I think breaks open that big networking program you alluded to.
Yeah, and I'll admit up front, I don't really like the name data router. Or, you know, I don't have a better name for it. We call it a routing service because people think of routers as physical things, you know, a box like a Cisco router or something like that. It's really not. It's really, you know, making sure the data gets to the right place some way. And it's really a critical thing to look at how that might work. So, you know, data routing, so this is a way to look at most systems out there. They're in DDS land, each of these gray boxes here is what I was calling a global address space. But you notice they aren't connected today. The room is not connected to the ward is not connected to the cloud. None of these things are connected together because they really often have different data types and different structures. And a data router actually exists to connect these things together. So you think of them as a gateway, but it's a data gateway. It's not a physical box necessarily. Sometimes it's implemented in a physical box, but it's a conceptual thing. And the whole idea is to provide a unified data model so you can have something, an algorithm running somewhere else in the cloud or whatever, can go down and get information out of a patient system. So a doctor might walk up to a monitor and say, hey, show me what happened with this patient over the last 4 hours. How does it know what to do with that, and where does it get that information? Well, that's sort of what the data router provides, along with some functionality in the middleware, is a way to do that. And importantly, it's not a server, it's a service, and the reason I say that is because if you can have one, you can have N, and, you know, the way to make it super robust is to have a lot of them. You can run them in devices, you can run them in their own special boxes, you can run them in the cloud, any way you want to put them, and the system is smart enough to only deliver the data that the other end asks for. It's not going to deliver it three times or something if you only ask for it once. So the redundant data routes connects the data spaces, not networks necessarily, or often it is, very reliably because you get multiple and completely transparently. You're still just reading and writing what looks like your local memory. That's sort of the trick of the data router. And it's not like it's only done there. I'm sorry. Are you going to ask a question?
Nope.
Anyhow, you know, we actually, this is called the layered data bus architecture. The ISE calls it that. It's a great name. It's a very general architecture. It scales well. It's used in lots of places. I'll give you some quick examples. So this is the Grand Coulee Dam. It's the largest power plant in North America. It's also the fastest, and it can take its almost 7 gigawatts off, on and off the net in about 10 minutes. And it used to just be base load, always putting out the same amount of power, but as wind and solar come online and they aren't reliable, they're clean energy, but they're what's called dirty power because you can't rely on how much power comes out of them. Something has to balance that, and they change the architecture to be an autonomous balancing system. So it's actually autonomously balancing the Western grid. Exact same architecture I just showed you, layered data bus architecture, a very simplified version. But now, you know, you've got remote systems out there and it has to be super reliable. So the redundant data routing, just like you need for your system, it's actually got 600,000 data values in this thing. So it's a very large system and a very similar system. And it's also another medical system. It's actually GE's Revolution CT scanner, which is I wish I could spend 3 hours talking about this machine. I'm blown away by what this thing can do. But, you know, it can basically look inside you and get an image of anything going on in your body. It's truly amazing. But it's also a same kind of a layered data bus architecture that makes that work. And, you know, we use it in all of our kinds of systems that make the system robust and fast. You know, this has only about maybe 50 CPUs in it, but it still has to be high speed. It can't fail. It's, you know, doing very high precision control, things like that with millisecond timing or better. So, you know, we see lots of things going on in the industry, and I just wonder maybe you could give us a quick overview of the trends you see that are really making networking challenging.
Yeah, so a few things, and keep an eye on time a little bit too as well, Dan. So I think in the picture here, we're showing our central monitoring unit, which is one of the things that GE offers our customers today, and we're seeing more and more requests for this. So essentially, when this is, we talk about the nurse station being on the floor, hospitals have technicians and nurses looking remotely, sometimes in different buildings, entire population. So this is something happening increasingly in hospitals. And so once again, you get into that whole, I need the data, bring it here, bring it reliably. And so, you know, when you're sleeping at night and there's less people, less staff on, these are the people who are actually watching, these are the type of people and processes that are watching over you. And so that's all about patient safety. The other thing is on wearable devices. So so today we have, you know, most parameters that we measure have cables and things like this and attaching to the monitor. It's well known in the industry, in the healthcare industry, the sooner you get mobile and the sooner that you can move around, the quicker your recovery becomes. So therefore, that's wearable devices, so devices that are, we try to make them almost invisible to the user, right, to make those parameters smaller, and then go wireless as well so that the patient can start moving around, go to the bathroom, walk in the corridors so that they can start their recovery as quickly as possible. And as soon as you start doing that, you have more scale challenges. So, and then obviously wireless is not connected, is another game as, compared to wired networks as well. And all that has to be working at the same time. So we really see a big trend and direction into getting patients mobile. And with that, it's just, and then you've got patients moving around in that network as well. So we see more challenges on that. And I think super opportunity though for our patients. And then, you know, last but not least, it's analytics. So with data availability, that allows you to look at what is happening at the patient in a whole new way. So for example, you can start using AI or an algorithm to say, you know, based on this patient, what could be the expected outcomes from when you compare it to thousands of other cases, for example. And you can't do that on individual devices, but if the data is extremely available and accessible, you can run that continuously in the background. Or another thing that hospitals look doing more and more of with us is clinical decision support. So in that case, you've got, maybe you're looking at your population of patients and you say, and you want to understand how efficient or productive am I in actually meeting the needs of those patients. Or are there certain patients or certain setups, for example, which are causing more alarm than others? And if so, why? And sometimes it's just as easy, as simple as, well, we have that patient in a certain setting and they're causing a lot of false alarms, for example. And then the doctor and nurse can collaborate and say, hey, we can change that around. And then we've actually made them reduce the amount of the alarms, those false alarms coming into the nurse's station. So big focus on mobility, scaling, wearables, and analytics. So I look at that and say, look, we've got a set of life critical and I like to think intellectually interesting problems to solve. So when you look at those challenges, why DDS go to the system?
So I always try to go back to sort of the architecture and why that makes sense. So it's definitely mobility at scale is a real problem out there, challenge, and actually is where DDS was first invented, aerospace robotics lab at Stanford for mobile flying intelligent things. So it's always been sort of about mobility. And it's, you know, the very simple way to look at it, if you remember this orange box that I tried to make a big deal out of, data-centric really means transparent sharing. So this is the way you draw it here. You see it like this. I think of it as each algorithm and each patient, whatever that data thing is, has the orange box, whatever data is in it. It doesn't really matter where it is. And so if Oliver here starts moving around the hospital and even changes IP addresses, it doesn't change the relationships between anybody. If an algorithm moves up into the cloud or something, that doesn't change relationships as long as you can still get the right data at the right place at the right time with the right reliability, the right quality of service. All of that is going to work. It's just, you know, the data literally lives in the network. It doesn't live anywhere else. And, you know, so data centricity is really all about, you know, decoupling space, flow, and time. It doesn't matter where it is. It doesn't matter how fast something else needs it. It doesn't matter what network it goes over. It doesn't matter when it joins, when it leaves, or even how old it is, the device, because you can upgrade things independently because it does data type matching. And even do things like take legacy devices and add a little adapter to put it into the same format as everything else. It's a possible thing to do. Lots of our customers do that in various areas. And it really is, you know, it grew up in mobile systems, one of our biggest markets in autonomous vehicles. Here's a quick diagram from that world, you know, what it looks like with streets and cars and cities and all these kind of things. It really is the same architecture in these environments, it allows you to take mobile systems and make them intelligent, distributed. It's really what it's all about. But yeah, I just wanted to sort of end by talking about how impressed I am and amazed I am at the challenge that GE Healthcare has with, you know, 300 different types of devices and ventilators and respirators and oximeters and incubators and ECG monitors and on, and a, you know, big hospital might have 200,000 or 300,000 of these devices, and somehow I see that problem as I've got to find Oliver in that world, and Oliver's moving around and get the right information about Oliver to the right algorithm and set the right alarms off on time. That's a wonderful, hard networking challenge that, you know, we are really happy to work on. The graph at the bottom of this thing, by the way, is a simulation we did in our lab when we first starting off on this project. Each of those red dots is data router. Think of it as a room. There's about 300 of them on that diagram. So there's, you know, 300 rooms. So this is a, you know, small hospital. But they're all redundantly connected. We actually did a test where you walk through the lab, just randomly yank wires out of the wall and, you know, make sure it still works, make sure we can handle the data flow rates, all those kind of things. The technical challenge is just amazing and daunting with different kinds of networks and patients and, you know, real time, sometimes video and waveforms, and that real time information needs to get to the nurse's station sometimes in milliseconds. And, it just has to always run, and security and Today, all these things are separate, and tomorrow it's going to be an intelligent, distributed system. The technology really is joining the care team. I look at this industry, and I see that the medical industry is, in the future, going to compete on networking. Today, it competes on device parameters and device capabilities, and we'll always need that. But more and more, it's going to be about intelligence and networking and reliability, and that's sort of what this whole direction is all about. So I thought, maybe I'll let Oliver talk. What trends and directions do you see out there that's really impacting the industry?
I've had a few of those, and in the interest of time, I'll wrap up a little bit. And we talked about mobility, for example, and data. I would say one thing that I do see, which is different, is that our hospitals are demanding this data as well. And so we have hospitals and customers, and they have data scientists on staff, which is really interesting. So now it's not about, hey, just we want these boxes. This is about, they're asking for this, and in fact, they demand it from us, and we want the data because we want to become better ourselves. I think one of those futures, I think, is that I've met with customers at some of the most prestigious hospitals, and you have these doctors with PhDs and all this kind of good stuff, and they have so many ideas, and they're asking, give us the data, and so we can optimize what we do. And what I can see is that they will be able to be partners with us, encapsulate those algorithms, encapsulate those thoughts, and then we'll be able to give those to other hospitals as well, so they can kind of get the world leading approach to medicine can then be transported, so to speak, into other environments, maybe smaller hospitals which can't afford to hire data scientists and stuff.
We're sort of running out of time here, so I just wanted to let us finish up. Maybe I guess this is your slide.
I just wanted to say hats off to the DDS team at RTI. I mean, we work with you guys, and one of the things I think we're changing ourselves is that we're trying to, RTI is, we like to do as a vendor, but really you are a partner to us. And so for the engineers on the line, we've got RTI engineers who have pretty much full access to our systems here at GE Healthcare, and our teams work together as we make sure that we address these problems properly. And, what's challenging, I think, for the DDS, for the RTI team, is that a lot of those examples, they have similar challenges, but they're all completely different. And, once in a while, we do hit things where we go, oh, we haven't thought of that, or what's going on here? And I just want to say to you, Stan, I think your team has been phenomenal in helping us, very responsive, great expertise. And I appreciate that we can take the expertise you have from those other industries and bring them into healthcare. It's super exciting.
Thanks for that. And on our side, I've always seen that, going back to this OR example, the GE team is just dedicated to this. It's a long-term stable team, which I have a lot of respect for. We've also tried to do that. And, yeah, you have to worry about how much things cost or how to compete in the market, how to be profitable to shareholders. But drive day to day, my team and my engineers keep coming back and say, oh, GE is all about patient safety, clinical outcomes, how we can best support the clinicians. It really is patient-centric. I'm rarely this impressed with one of our customers. You're one of the most sophisticated DDS users out there, and you're doing a great job with implementing DDS and data centricity as a real future. We're proud to be part of the team, and it's great to see this going forward.
So. Thank you, Stan.
I think we're going to have to cut it off here, guys. We could go on forever, obviously, but we are out of time with this webinar. There were some questions that we did not have a chance to answer, and somebody will get back to you after the fact. We promise we do that, and we will. I'd like to thank both Stan and Oliver for fantastic presentations and the dialogue. It was very eye-opening for me, and it was a good format to having you guys go back and forth. I think a lot of the questions that were asked were actually answered in your conversation. As a final reminder, all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without any prior permission. And lastly, I'd like to thank the audience because none of these things are possible without you. So thank you all for attending and have a great day.